This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This week, NPR is exploring a topic that's often the butt of jokes, middle age. The focus stems from a new book and 3 years of research by Barbara Bradley Haggerty, longtime former NPR religion correspondent and author of 2 books, including her latest, just out today, called Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. That's right, opportunity. Even with all the angst about midlife crises and birthday cards teasing their recipients as over the hill, the author says the middle years are often about renewal. Today in The Exchange, Barbara Bradley Haggerty on what she discovered about middle age in America. And let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Have you had what felt like a midlife crisis? How did you pull out of it? And what's your overall impression of midlife? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Barbara, a huge welcome to you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be here, Laura. Thank you.
So what's the mythology, Barbara, around midlife? You know, all the black balloons that people get on their 40th birthday or the jokes about being over the hill. What's our general mythology around this?
Well, yes, I know. The mythology actually began kind of in 1965, and it is a myth, and I'm going to tell you about that. But it began with a really obscure article in a journal by a man named Elliot Jacques. And he essentially said that there is this, men experience this existential dread of failing to realize their dreams. And he called the article Death in the Midlife Crisis. And then eventually Gail Sheehy picked it up, and she wrote a book called Passages. And suddenly, you know, everyone is anticipating dumping their spouse, getting a red sports car, you know, Lester Burnham in American Beauty. But here's what happened, Laura. All of this mythology grew up, but around 20 years ago, U.S. researchers started to kind of try to find whether midlife crisis was a really common thing. And they looked and they looked and they interviewed lots and lots of people. And what they found is only about 10% of the population experiences kind of existential crisis. So it really, it happens, but it's quite rare.
So what are the black balloons and the jokes and all, you know, what does that reflect? Is it, you know, youth-obsessed culture, fear of death? I mean, what's going on with that?
You know, I think there is something going on. I mean, I actually don't know how old you are, but I'll tell you, I am 56. And I can say that in my 40s, I began to feel like life was a little bit different, that it was a little bit flatter, it was harder. It seemed a little bit more, I don't know, dreary, like things didn't taste as good. You know what I mean? And what was happening is I was experiencing what economists call the U-curve of happiness. This is really common. Economists have looked in like 75 countries and they've asked people, are you happy? And what they have found is that people go through this dip in midlife. They start out life, you know, in their 20s, really happy, excited about life. Life is new and exciting. They go along, and in their 40s and 50s, they reach this nadir, and then they begin to pull out of it, and right through their 50s and 60s and 70s, life gets a lot happier for them. So if you are experiencing these kind of doldrums, you're not alone. Virtually everyone experiences it as well. But it's not a midlife crisis. It's more like a temporary feeling that passes for most people.
What's the cause of that bottom of the U-curve? I've drawn it right here in my sheet of paper. And
I know. Right. Well, they're not quite sure, but here's what most people think. Most people think that when you are younger, when you're 20 and 30, you have these high expectations about what your life will be like. You will have a perfect family, perfect kids. You will be the CEO. You will be the, you know, pitcher for the Red Sox, whatever it is. And then reality sets in. Life gets hard. You have mortgages, da-da-da. You realize you're not going to be CEO and you're not going to be the pitcher. And you begin to kind of, it's a little bit of a funk of these dashed expectations and then the fact that life is just hard. It's more, it's more burdened because, I mean, it's good, a good burden, you know, you have kids, you have family, but it's not as giddy as maybe your life was when you were freer in your 20s. And what happens is people begin to reconcile that, those dashed expectations, and they begin to say, you know what, I've got a really good life. I mean, I've got a family I love. My kids aren't perfect, but they're pretty darn good. I have friends. You know, life is good. And they begin to focus on things that are more, or for them, more important. And that usually is relationships and causes that they feel are important.
Well, you also bump up against your limitations in midlife, your physical limitations. Yep. You know, you joke about pulling a hamstring after a 1 mile jog. So you're kind of coping and dealing with those restrictions. You feel like things are being taken away from you.
You are. You are. But, you know, it's interesting because you actually don't have to succumb to those limitations. I mean, yes, we are older. I will never run a marathon under 3 hours. Okay. That's not going to happen. However, what the research shows is that people can continue to really be vibrant physically as long as they exercise. I mean, you know, I went to the senior games and observed those. And what I was seeing were that, you know, 52-year-olds, 55-year-olds were swimming at a college pace.
Wow.
They were doing as well as college students. And that's because they were exercising. They were not giving up. You know, someone told me a really interesting analogy. This is a woman named Kathy Uchsnyder, and she coaches a lot of middle-aged elite athletes. They don't start elite, but she coaches them that way. And what she said to me is that when you're young, there are a lot of markers. You graduate from high school and from college, you get married, you get a job, you have kids, you begin raising a family. There are all these markers. And then you hit midlife. And midlife is like this paragraph without any punctuation, without commas or semicolons or periods. It just goes on and on and on. What you need to do is you need to put in markers. You need to have small goals. And for a lot of people, it is athletics, or it could be something like, you know, learning how to speak Spanish when you're midlife. I've talked to a lot of people like that, or picking up the flute again, or whatever it is. But you need to kind of break up that paragraph with punctuation, and you will be a lot happier. And so that circles me back to, yeah, people are suffering some kind of debilities, but you can work on it and you can feel very healthy. I feel healthy. Do you feel healthy?
Most of the time, although I have been known to pull my back out emptying the dishwasher, yeah. But giving away my own midlife status. And, you know, Barbara, you're being modest. We should let people know that you actually participated in a senior race as part of this whole book. You decided, okay, if I'm going to, you know, report this research and tell people how great it is to have these markers and these important challenges, and I guess I should go do it myself. You competed in a pretty high-level bicycle race.
Yes. Well, and maybe people will be encouraged to know the reason I did that, the reason I began bicycling at all, is because I'd been a lifelong runner, but I got arthritis in my right knee, and I literally could not walk up a flight of stairs. It was that painful. So I began to spin and cycle because it didn't hurt my knees. Well, when I was doing the research for my book, I met a guy named Mike Adsit, who was a 4-time cancer survivor. And the first time he got cancer, he was very, very kind of sick from the chemotherapy. And he turned on the television and he saw the Tour de France and he saw Lance Armstrong racing before his fall from grace, of course. And he realized that here was this guy who was a cancer survivor. So Mike began to bike. And he got stronger and stronger and stronger, and he competed 3 times in the senior games, which is for athletes 50 and older. It's kind of they really are good athletes. I mean, it's remarkable. But he began to compete, and when I interviewed him, he kind of tricked me into going for a bike ride with him. We did the interview at my house, and he brought his bike, and we went out. And he basically, I put a microphone on him and I said, okay, Mike, let's go. Show me how you do intervals. And he goes, well, this is what we're going to do. And I said, what, we? No, you are going to do the intervals. And he goes, no, we are going to do these intervals. And we finished this ride and he goes, okay, I'm going to coach you. You're going to qualify for the senior games and we're going to get you in there.
What did that mean to you?
Oh, gosh. You know what? It was what I said about Kathy Utschneider really became true for me. It gave me little goals. You see, when I'd been a deadline reporter for 30 years. I'd worked for the Christian Science Monitor and then NPR. And some of the time at NPR, I was a Justice Department correspondent. So I was always under a deadline. But when I left to write a book, it's kind of a seamless, quiet, solitary activity. And I didn't really have any deadlines. I mean, I had a huge deadline, but I didn't have daily deadlines. What this did for me is it kind of demarcated the days for me. I would get up and I'd think, okay, I'm going to do this kind of interval training, or okay, I'm going to, you know, ride 50 miles or whatever it would be. And I had these little goals. And so even though my book had a very long deadline, I created really short deadlines, and it gave me a sense of victory. Do you know what I mean? Like, you need that. You need daily, kind of little daily goals. And so it gave me a victory, and it also gave me kind of a larger purpose, which I know sounds highfalutin and everything. It's a bicycle race, right? But it gave me a purpose, something to get up for. And so it really meant a lot. The other thing that meant a lot was, and this is true of a lot of hobbies, you know, I made a new friend. I made a lot of friends, actually, through biking. And how often in our 50s do we make new friends? It's not very often. We're too busy. So that was a real bonus for me as well.
Well, purpose is one of the big, big things you talk about in this book. And also, you know, just dealing with the aging body, dealing with the aging brain, kind of getting yourself out of that flatter, harder mode and way of thinking. You also mentioned your career change, Barb, and I would like to ask you broadly about midlife careers. How, because that's often a complaint you hear about midlife too, you know, life is blah, I feel blah at work. How engaged right. did you find middle-aged folks are in their careers?
Well, here's a really disturbing piece of news. Gallup has done surveys, massive surveys, since the year 2000. And what they find is that about one-third of midlifers are actually engaged in their work. And about one in five, almost one in five, are actively disengaged, which means they really don't like what they're doing every day. It's a toxic experience for them. And, you know, I should say that when you are disengaged with work, it's bad for your health, too. I mean, people who are disengaged are more likely to be sick. They're more likely to report depression. They're more likely to have high cortisol levels, so, you know, stress hormones. And so it's not a good thing to be disengaged in work. It's a fairly serious problem for both the employer and for the employee if they're disengaged. So I did talk to a lot of people about that. You know, what was it? What made people engaged in their work? And one thing that I found is that there's kind of a new math to midlife career. And the new math is that unlike our parents, we can't retire at 60, 65 or 60 probably. We're going to have to keep working. So if you have to work another 10, 15, 20 years, do you just want to do a job that you don't like, that you're hanging on, you know, and kind of unhappy about? Or do you want to kind of look at yourself and try to pivot your career so that you are doing something that you really feel is meaningful and purposeful? And if I might, let me just mention this study that was done out of Denmark. I wish we had done it in the U.S., but we haven't. In Denmark, they looked at what makes people happy at work. And they had a lot of different things, you know, management and, you know, colleagues and benefits and things like that. The number one thing that made people happy at work was whether they felt their work had purpose. And that could be either that their job, you know, had meaning, or that their company or organization had a larger mission that was helping society. That was twice as important as leadership, which was the runner-up. So having a purpose in your work is unbelievably important. It also is very healthy. all the research on purpose shows that people with purpose in life, you know, their memories, they keep their memories longer. They don't show signs of dementia. They're healthier. They don't have heart attack or stroke, or they're less likely to have heart attacks and stroke, all of that. So that's what I did. I looked at people who I talked to people who were really happy in their career and how they and what they did.
Was there class distinctions among people, mm-hmm. midlife Americans, who were more or less engaged with their jobs?
Well, actually, that was a really surprising thing. Midlifers, Gen Xers and baby boomers who were college educated were less engaged and more disengaged than those with a high school degree. And, you know, I asked the researcher what this was about, and he said he thinks it's dashed expectations. He thinks that what happens with midlifers, as opposed to, you know, people with a high school diploma where they don't have expectations that they're going to become the CEO or whatever, a lot of people do who are college educated do have these expectations. That's what he said. And, you know, it's something that people have to deal with, and they have to be really cognizant of. And what I would say is, you know, don't just quit your job, but you do need to think carefully about what gives you meaning and whether there's a way to use those qualities that you're really good at, your talents, your experience, your passions, use them in a way that is kind of more central to your work.
Yeah, especially since you may be working until 70 or 75. Right. Barbara, let's go to the phones. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Tanya's calling from Bedford. Hi, Tanya. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you. I'm glad that you touched on that last point, because honestly, for the last 15 minutes, this sounded like a discussion only about midlife for a small section of America. I mean, this wasn't my father's midlife. This wasn't, like, my mom's midlife. Like, you know, working in a paper mill, he wasn't exactly like, oh, I'm having a midlife crisis, I'm going to pivot my career now.
Yeah, he didn't chance, did he? Yeah, go ahead, Tanya.
No, I mean, like I said to your screener, it's an interesting topic, but It really just rankles my blue-collar sensibilities.
Sure. Hey, Tanya, I really appreciate you calling. So, Barbara, let's talk about that. Is this whole idea of, you know, life reimagined, opportunity of midlife, is it sort of for those who have the ability, as Tanya says?
Yes, I think Tanya really does make an excellent point. Researchers researchers have not found as much, quote, existential angst among people without a college degree. And I think that's partly because they are too darn busy. I mean, they are busy, you know, sometimes holding a couple of jobs. They don't have the luxury to have existential angst. And I think Tanya makes a really, really good point It's kind of a privilege, you know, in a way, to have a midlife crisis. It's kind of a middle class or upper middle class kind of thing to do, you know. And you see this actually in marriage research as well. You see that the really interesting thing about marriage right now is that there is kind of a gray divorce revolution, meaning that a lot of baby boomers are getting divorced. And what you're seeing with the gray divorce revolution is that people who it's kind of bifurcated. Some marriages are extraordinarily happy. They're very fulfilled. But those are the marriages where people can afford to spend time with each other, go on vacations. They maybe have help with childcare. These are people who are privileged. A lot of other people have a much harder time in marriage, and you see that in the divorce rates, because they don't have time to invest in each other. They are not thinking, how can I make my spouse's or partner's aspirations come true? They're thinking about how, you know, the next paycheck, can I get another job? How do I get, you know, my kid is sick, but my husband is working or my partner's working and I have to work. What do I do about that? So there is, in both work and in marriage, there's almost a privilege to have a good marriage or to have the luxury of having a midlife crisis or to rethink your career. So it's very bifurcated.
So the gray divorce revolution, that's really interesting. The divorce rate in the United States has been high for a long time. Is it higher among midlife folks?
Yeah, it's twice as high as it was for our parents' generation. It's a real problem. I mean, it's interesting because the reason that it's come about is because, for actually good reasons. One is that people are living longer. And so, you know, in the old days, when if you lived to be kind of 60 or 65 and you weren't very happy in your marriage, you'd go, well, you know, what's the point of getting a divorce? I'm only going to be alive for a few more years. I mean, that was a subconscious thing. Now people are living so much longer. They can say, you know, at 55, they go, well, you know what? I might live another 35 years. That's a whole marriage. That's a whole new chapter. And so if this person isn't making me happy, I think I'll move on. The other factor has been that women are working now. And what that means is women can afford to get divorced, whereas before they might not have been. Now they have the financial independence to say, this person is not making me happy. And they're usually the ones who ask for the divorce. So that's another factor that's happened. And then in the third, you know, is kind of what we just alluded to, that the expectations of marriage are so much higher than they used to be, so different. You know, before it was okay to have gender roles. The mother was a housekeeper, the wife was a housekeeper, the person who raised the children and ran the house, the man brought in the income. Now we want our spouse to be everything. We want him to be, you know, the help with bringing up the children, to bring in money, to be my confidant, my best friend, you know, my romantic partner, the one who will help my dreams come true. And it's really a hard, high bar. And so a lot of
it's
people
almost
say,
funny hearing you yeah, say that. You think that's impossible. Who could do that?
Well, it is. It is. And for a lot of people, it is impossible. And I think that's one reason, and not just me, the researchers think that is one reason that a lot of people are getting divorced.
How do men and women experience midlife struggles differently, Barbara? What do we know about this?
Well, it's actually, there's a lot of stereotype and kind of one fact. Okay, so let me give you the fact. The fact is that men and women experience a midlife dip at different times. So women experience it when they're 40 on average and men at 50. And then you have your stereotypes. So the stereotypes are that, you know, all men kind of they feel this loss of youth, and they look ahead and they think, oh my gosh, I need a second chance. And so they dump their wives and they get the sports car and they maybe quit their jobs and they follow their muse and all of that. Well, that research was based on really a very small sample of men. And as we talked about, you know, it doesn't appear to be true. Then the women have their own stereotype, and that stereotype is that once the children leave, I'm going to have this empty nest, the empty nest syndrome, and I'm going to be miserable and fall into depression and wonder what my meaning in life is, what's my purpose. And, you know, women do get sad, of course, so do men, when their children leave. But the research shows that really women are pretty happy to not have to do the laundry all the time. Women are pretty happy to have their kids be adults, and they're happy to have their house back. So that's a stereotype, too. So what I would say is that, yeah, they experience midlife a little bit differently, but let's not fall into the trap.
More on Midlife Reimagined in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with Barbara Bradley Haggerty, author of two books, including her latest just released today. It's called Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. And Exchange listeners, let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. If you are in that middle years of your life, what's your overall impression of middle age? Does it feel flat and blah? Do you see some of the opportunity that Barbara Bradley Haggerty talks about? We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And Barbara, going back to our caller, Tanya, who mentioned how she felt that folks with her working class background didn't have the luxury of, you know, examining midlife and reinventing themselves. You were writing this book, doing some of the research in the post-recession era. How much did that get mixed up with what your interview subjects called midlife malaise or midlife crisis?
Okay, this is a really important thing. One of the things about academic research, which is, I was looking at a lot of academic research, is there's a lag time. So it takes a while to get the interviewers out there to collate you know, all the interviews and write up an academic paper and get it published in an academic journal. And what that means is when I was doing the research, they had not captured the effect of the 2008 recession, the Great Recession. And so what they said is that several researchers told me that if they were to look at this information now, if they were going to look at people now and get all of the angst about the recession, they would see a lot more midlife malaise. Maybe not midlife crisis, but midlife malaise. We sent out a Facebook call out. We've sent out a call out on NPR's Facebook page, and it was basically, you know, how's midlife treating you? And within a couple of hours, we got 700 emails.
They
were unbelievable. They were so beautiful. These were masterpieces. I mean, they were lovely. But the biggest trigger, the biggest source of unhappiness for people was that they had lost their jobs and they couldn't find another one. And, you know, it made me begin to think 55 is the new 65, right? That it's really hard to get back into the workplace once you are in your 50s. This was a big source of angst for people. What I should say is I kept in touch with a lot of people, and almost all of them, with very few exceptions, found another job. And they were happy. Their job may not have been as high-paying as their previous one, but they were kind of working their way back. It's not a totally happy story, a totally happy outcome, but it wasn't disastrous either. So what, you know, I think the recession was really big, and I think it speaks more to an external crisis as opposed to an existential one. And by that I mean, psychologists kind of make a distinction between a midlife crisis, which is this internal angst about, you know, not being able to fulfill your dreams by the time you die, and a crisis that occurs in midlife, which would be something terrible happening. You lose your job, you lose your spouse, you lose your parents, you know, you get divorced. That is a crisis at midlife. It's an external crisis. Most people recover from that, just as most people I talked with and interviewed recovered from their setback with their careers as well. So the recession's a big deal. It could turn into a midlife crisis if people were completely unable to get a job, because that goes to your very identity. Who am I if I'm not working? But for most people, they were able to get back on their feet.
You did say in an interview on Morning Edition, for every, you know, one distressed email or Facebook comment you received, you got 10 positive ones. I was taken aback by that.
Yeah. You know, and what I should say is that they were, when we say positive, what we have to say is it's kind of a mixed alloyed positiveness, in the sense that midlife is a really complicated time. You know, your knees are sagging, you know, you feel like your younger people are passing you at work. They're certainly better at technology. So it's not a time that is easy. You've got a lot of burdens, a lot of responsibilities. You may have kids, you may have a mortgage maybe. You're hoping that your kids will go to college. You may be taking care of aging parents, that kind of thing. So it's not an easy time, but it is a meaningful time. And by that, you know, that's what researchers are really interested in, kind of long term, this idea of having meaning and purpose in your life. So if, you know, you may not be giddy. You may not be going out with your friends and, you know, dancing on the tabletops as you might have. I didn't, but other people might have in their 20s. But what happens in midlife is people begin to reassess and think about what's really important in life. And generally what they do is they say, you know what's important? My relationships, my friendships, my family, and also that I'm doing something meaningful, whether it's a cause or whether it's work or whatever it is. And they begin to reassess what is truly important. And they quit defining themselves so much as their career. And they begin kind of redefining themselves as to what is important in life. And so those people who were able to make this adjustment, those people were very happy. They were humorous. I mean, they thought it's funny that I can't remember where my keys are. Or, you know, I left the gas running in my car like all day long once. And so, you know, I left my car on and I come back to an empty tank. I mean, but it's kind of funny. And so if you can really reassess and pivot so that you're not kind of focused on the negatives, but really see what's important, the positive, those are the people who are really happy.
I've got another question for you on that exact point, but I love the question you threw out to your Facebook listeners at NPR. How's midlife treating you? So let me again ask our listeners what they would say to that question. How's midlife treating you? The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So let's go to that point, the positive attitude. I mean, it sounds so basic, but one huge takeaway that you did find after doing all this research, Barbara, and you did a ton, is that old adage, you are what you think. I mean, you know, obviously thinking positively isn't going to bring you, you know, huge riches or, you know, cure you of cancer, but it does mean a lot, and it's so important in midlife. Give us a little bit more there, Barbara.
Yeah, you know, this actually comes from my mother. My mother is 94 years old, and she's sharp as a tack, and she had a phrase that she would always say to my brother and me. She'd say, your thinking is your experience. And what she meant by that is it really does matter how you respond to things. And it how you think and how you respond really affects how you experience the world. So I saw this in a number of ways. One is, you know, actually scientific. You see it in your brain. The brain is plastic. The brain is able to learn new stuff. Midlife dogs can learn new tricks. And that's what I found. I mean, I ended up doing, it was actually a fairly traumatic experience. I hate standardized tests. And I ended up taking a standardized kind of IQ test to measure my intelligence, doing some brain training for a month and coming back and measuring my, they gave me tests again to measure kind of my Q, my IQ, my fluid intelligence, how good I am at figuring out novel problems that I've never seen before. And it turned out that in that month, I improved overall on all the tests, I improved 18%. But in the kind of gold standard test called the Raven's test, I improved 75%.
So the brain is plastic, even in midlife.
So the brain is plastic. The brain, you can continue to learn right through your 70s. And actually, I love this part of the research because I think one of the big fears, for me at least, is that I'm going to kind of lose my memory. I'm just going to get slower and dumber with each passing year, right? And you know, I think a lot of people fear that. But if I can just dive into the science right now about brains, we have kind of two types of intelligence that researchers are interested in. One is the fluid intelligence, solving novel problems. Think, you know, Sherlock Holmes, okay? And then we have another type of it. And that fluid intelligence begins, this is really bad news, it begins to drop off after around age 30. And we become slower and we're not as good at solving novel problems. And we just feel dumber. But there's something called crystallized intelligence. And crystallized intelligence is all the stuff you scoop up in a lifetime. It is your expertise. It's vocabulary. It's wisdom. It's learning how to navigate the workplace. It's being a surgeon who's 50 years old and has seen that problem before and won't get panicked, you know, in the operating room versus a 30-year-old surgeon who might not have seen that problem before. So there is this crystallized intelligence which really increases right into your 70s. And so the really cool news about midlife is actually your peak operating time for your brain. It is when you haven't lost too much fluid intelligence, you haven't slowed down that much, but you have gained tremendously in expertise and in wisdom. And it is when we are operating at our peak.
I can hear the midlife audience cheering and saying,
phew! Isn't that great? I know.
Let's go back to our listeners, Barbara. And Vinny's joining us from Nashua. Hi, Vinny. You're on The Exchange. Welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you. As I'm listening to the radio broadcast, I really, really love it. I think one thing that stands out for me is that every human being longs for four things. And when one thing is missing, they can experience midlife crisis at any time of their life. And I think these four things are presence, love, health, and a purpose. I believe that if one of those things are missing within your life, you get to experience midlife crisis.
Vinny, was the first thing you said presence? Is that what you said? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, being present. Mm-hmm. Being present as in knowing that you matter, you know, knowing that your voice matters and feeling like what you're doing is actually giving an input to the life around you.
Being present in that moment. Vinny, thank you so much for calling in. What do you think, Barbara?
I think that is so insightful. In fact, I wrote it down, so I'm going to steal it, Vinny. Okay, I'm using it in other interviews. I think that is incredibly insightful. And what he said about you can experience midlife crisis at any time, talk to any 25-year-old and they will tell you they are going through a quarter-life crisis. I mean, that's what I'm hearing all around, you know, when I tell people what I'm doing, they're like, oh, will you do a quarter-life crisis? It's like, I don't know what I'm doing with my life and I don't know who I'm going to marry and will my life have purpose and meaning? But I think that Vinny is absolutely right. Those are four essentials. And, you know, one thing I think you can do as you grow older, I think if one of those goes, you can rely on the others. So for example, health is a really difficult one. If you're having health problems, that's an enormous thing. I've had health problems. I had, you know, I have chronic pain in my vocal cords, and I'd lose my voice, which is a hard thing for a radio correspondent. I found that when I relied on other people, on finding a purpose, on, you know, feeling like I was doing something purposeful every day, and that notion that of being present. And it's not only that you matter, but it's that you're present in the moment, that you're not always thinking about what's ahead or what's behind, but you're actually present and enjoying this moment. You're stopping. Those things really helped me get through, you know, some of the worst of the vocal cord pain that I was having. And so I think there's a way to rely on the other three legs of the four-legged stool if one of them is giving you trouble. But I think his comment is so insightful.
Vinny, thank you so much for calling in. So, Barbara, a little bit more on Vinny's point number two. He said, in addition to presence, health, and purpose, he said love. And I did want to talk about midlife friendships and marriages. You talked about marriages a little bit earlier. But friendships, it's tricky. You mentioned that sometimes in midlife we're so busy and overwhelmed by, you know, aging parents and jobs and kids and mortgages and so forth, that we don't have time to seek out new friends. And yet in your book, you talked about you had to renegotiate some of your friendships. That was not the happiest chapter.
Yeah, that's a really hard one. There was a group of women that I'd met with. We'd met almost every, you know, once a week for almost 20 years.
That's a strong bond.
It's a very strong bond. And basically what happened is midlife happened in the sense that you know, one friend adopted a little boy and then another adopted a little girl. And, you know, one person got a really, really demanding job. And so what happened is that all these external events occurred and was drawing us further and further apart. It was like this centrifugal force, which is, frankly, what happens in midlife. And here, you know, what's kind of sad is when you get busy in midlife and you're just trying to get through the day and with the kids getting to school and you getting to your job and, you know, maybe taking care of parents or whatever it might be, volunteer work, whatever, the first thing to go is often your friendships. And that's actually the worst thing you can do, or just about the worst thing you could do, because friends are really, really important, not only emotionally, but biologically, to your doing well, to your thriving. Some studies suggest that friends are more important than family in keeping you healthy and helping you recover from cancer quickly and keeping your memory. The friends are really important. And one reason they think that's true is because friends are disposable. So like if a friend is causing you pain, you get rid of them, right? You just don't call up. But with a family, you know, you can't do that. And so there's additional strains and stresses with families that are hard to extricate yourself from. Friendships, you really kind of keep the friends that are health-giving for you. And so friendships are very, it's kind of the dirty little secret of midlife is that, you know, we drop our friends, but we really, really shouldn't. We need to keep in touch with them.
You kind of broke up with some of these women, to put it bluntly.
Yeah, I did. And it was, you know, kind of my fault. And I just misread it. You know, I think, you know this, Laura, people kind of view journalists in a different category, and no matter how long you've been friends with them, I think there's always a little bit of suspicion that, oh gosh, if you tell my story, it's going to be too private and whatever. Well, after I did my first book, my friends were kind of living through it with me, and we started joking about how they would be in my second book, and so I thought that would be okay. So when I did a chapter on friendship, I asked them if we could, talk about the ups of our friendships, how it benefited each other over these 20 years. And they felt really awkward about that. They felt that this had been a kind of a cone of silence, kind of like a priestly penitent thing where, we couldn't share each other's secrets. And already there had been this centrifugal force of we were too busy in our careers, we had kids, all of this other stuff was happening, and this seemed to be kind of the last straw, the straw that broke the camel's back. When I asked them if we could do this, if they could be in my book, and some of them agreed, but basically it was a catalyst for it all falling apart. It was tragic. And, we're trying to repair it. We're all friends individually, but we don't have that group anymore. And, I mean, it's kind of the saddest part of the whole midlife adventure for me is losing this group of friends.
Well, Vinnie, again, great call. Thank you so much. And he also mentioned purpose. Here's an email from Gary in Sugar Hill who says, great show. He says, a mentor of mine always stressed that work should be honorable and noble. And I'm reminded of the story of the janitor at NASA who was asked why he liked his job. And he said it was because he was helping to put a man on the moon. I think that our meaningfulness in life is what we want it to be. Gary, thank you so much. I think that relates perfectly to your comment, Barbara, about purpose. So, Gary, again, thank you. We will talk more with Barbara Bradley Haggerty about midlife, reimagining midlife, the science, art, and opportunity that she talks about in her book in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with Barbara Bradley Haggerty, author of two books, including her latest released just today. It's called Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. Give us a call. How's midlife treating you? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Barbara, we've talked about the midlife body, the midlife brain, the midlife career, the importance of that sense of purpose in midlife. Let's talk a little bit more about midlife marriage. You mentioned earlier the gray divorce revolution and how a lot of midlife couples are getting divorced. What did you find in your research about those couples who are not getting divorced? And this yeah. leads perfectly into the thing yeah. I love about this book is you got all this research, but you didn't just say, here's the research, folks. You kind of used yourself as a crash dummy for really, and used this research as to what can keep a midlife marriage alive in your own marriage. So go ahead, Barb. I'm throwing that all at you.
Yeah, right. Well, one of the interesting things actually about midlife marriage is there aren't a lot of rigorous studies that follow couples, from the time that they're married right through a midlife marriage. But there are a few of these, and there are some really great insights. Let me tick off a couple, and then I want to tell you the one that we took to heart. One of them is that researchers have found that people who talk in terms of we as opposed to I, we and us opposed to I and me, those couples are much more likely to be both happy and still married after 20 years. And obviously, it's a mindset. So a couple that feels like a team that's doing things together, they are going to be much more likely to be happy. People who have gone double dates, people say the best thing you can do on Valentine's Day is actually go on a double date. And that's because if you have friends, you see, you can actually make your spouse shine. You can brag on your spouse. And the friends actually keep a marriage alive. They keep you from Yeah, getting a divorce unnecessarily. They ratchet down some of the temperature level and all of that. So that's really important. I'll tell you one other thing that I was so surprised about, and then I want to talk about novelty. One of the things you hear all the time in midlife marriage research is opposites attract, then attack. But that's actually that, you know, you should be similar in personalities. But that's actually not true in midlife. It turns out that people who are different in personalities are much better at midlife, because midlife is about getting things done. So if you have someone who's really conscientious and wants to do the finances, and if you have two people like that, then no one's going to do the play dates for the kids. But if you have someone who's an extrovert and an introvert, then you're going to get all the kind of quiet stuff done, and you're going to have dinner with friends as well. And so midlife marriage actually defies that truism that you should be somewhat similar in personality. And I found that interesting. But the thing that we put into practice with my husband Devin and I is research by Art Aaron at Stony Brook, who suggested that novelty is really, really important for keeping a marriage alive. Right, yes. And
go ice skating. Do something crazy and different.
Exactly. Yeah. Go for a hike. You know, don't just go to the movies. Go for a hike. Go skiing. Do something that's out of the ordinary.
By the way, ice skating isn't that out of the ordinary for some people, but I'm a terrible
ice
skater.
Yes, that's
true. So for me,
true.
That would be. So go ahead.
That's true. So what we did is, I remember on our first date, we got married a little bit late. I was 43. Devin was 40. But I remember on our first date, Devin talked about how he really wanted to rent an RV and drive, you know, down the Blue Ridge Parkway. And I'm like, I can think of nothing as pointless or boring as doing that, you know?
How about a nice resort in the Caribbean?
Right, yeah. Right. I didn't quite say that because, you know, it was our first date and I was hopeful. But at any rate, after about, you know, 12 years of marriage or whatever, finally I hear this research about novelty. And I said to Devin, how would you like to rent an RV and drive down the Blue Ridge Parkway? And he was, of course, euphoric. And so we rent this RV. We take our dog, our Labrador Retriever, Sandra Day, and we invite two friends. And the five of us go down the Blue Ridge Parkway. Let me tell you why this was the best vacation ever, which it was.
Even though it broke down, even though the air conditioning broke, even though your brakes were bad, even though the RV company was sketchy.
Yeah, we didn't know. I mean, it was like one tiny little crisis after another. We didn't know how to empty the gray water or the black water. We didn't even know what black water was, and we won't discuss that here. We didn't know how to steer this thing. It's this huge vehicle. You look in the rearview mirror, and what you see is the bed in the back. You don't see outside. So it's really hard to kind of learn how to drive this thing. We had a ball, because every day was an adventure. We were doing something new and out of our comfort zone every single day. We went to different cities. We got stuck in a little flood. The brakes kind of almost went out. I mean, it sounds like a disaster, but it was a blast. And Art Aaron was right. We had fun because it was novel, and Devin keeps bugging me about when we're going to do, you know, another RV show.
With another company next time. Let's go back to our listeners, Barbara. And Bob's joining us from Rochester. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome. Bob, good morning. You're on the air. All right. I guess Bob isn't there. Bob, I hope you call back. Just got an email in from Molly. She says, this conversation with Barbara Haggerty brings thoughts on midlife from Carl Jung. In this view, midlife is as significant as adolescence, a great turning which can go on for years, bringing opportunities for self-development. Molly says it is a time for moving towards wholeness and balance. It's a time for exploring what we don't know about ourselves. Molly says, one of my friends says it's time for, quote, filling up the holes, taking time to focus on what we may have missed in our earlier years. Molly, thank you so much for the comments. I love that last one, filling up the holes. What do you think, Barbara?
Yeah, I think she is so right. And you know, what's interesting is that researchers are finding that we actually begin to do that naturally. It's part of that reassessment that we were talking about before, that you begin to quit defining yourself so much by your career success or whether, you know, your kids look are the captain of the football team or whatever, and you start kind of focusing on what's really important, how much you love your kids, how much you love your spouse or your friends or your parents or whatever. But something else is going on as well, and that is that our brains are actually getting more glass half full as we get older. As we get older, what we do is instead of kind of looking up the ladder, how do we climb up the ladder, we begin to scan the horizon. And we say, what is really important? And what our brains do is they begin to disattend or ignore bad news. They find this in brain studies. And they begin to focus on the good news, or in the brain studies, it's like happy pictures. And whereas young people are like all about the anxious pictures and less about the happy pictures, we begin to shift and we begin to appreciate life much more. And that, I think, brings this kind of relaxation about it's not just what my how I look externally to other people. There's more to life than appearances. I know that sounds trite, but it actually happens. And I think Carl Jung is right. And I think what we do is we begin to say, what is meaningful for me? What is really purposeful for me? Is it really working 80 hours a week? No, it actually isn't. What's more meaningful is to volunteer at this organization. I'm going to cut back a little bit at work and I'm going to volunteer at this organization. And that is meaningful, or I'm going to invest in my kids. And so we do begin to fill up, as she said, we begin to fill up these holes.
Molly, thank you so much for the email. And Bob is back from Rochester. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Go ahead, Bob.
I'm 70, and after 35 years in the corporate world, I decided I have a love for writing, and I have published 2 books.
Wow. And so do you just chuck it all, Bob, at midlife and start writing books?
No, I retired. I'm one of those old guys who is kind of pushed into retirement.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Bob, thank you for calling in. And, you know, we talked about that earlier with the recession. Some people pushed into that midlife reimagined. So there's Bob, right. And it turns out it has a happy ending for him. Bob,
yeah,
thank you for calling. So a couple last questions for you, Barbara, if we could. I love this part about the book, too. You did all this research. You traveled all around. You interviewed, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people and went through all these experiments yourself. And then you found one of the prime examples of everything that you had uncovered. It turned out to be right before you. I'm talking about your mom. She's mm-hmm. a shiny example right there about how to live midlife and beyond. How does your mom kind of just tie all this research together?
Oh, my mom is. Can I tell you a quick story? Let's see. Do we have time?
Okay, yeah, sure.
So mom has a stroke at age 89, and this was about 5 years ago. She has a stroke at age 89. We are not sure that she'll ever speak again. And it was really, actually, it was the catalyst for me doing this book, because I thought, you know, she's like my best friend. And I thought I'd basically lost my best friend. And it was kind of the catalyst for all these other anxious, you know, the dailiness of work, all these other pressures. And I began to wonder if I was having a midlife crisis. And my husband asked me not to have a midlife crisis. And he asked me to do the research on how not to have one instead. And that's why I have this book, right? But my mother, about a week after she has a stroke, she hasn't been able to talk. And the neurologist comes into the room and says, Mrs. Bradley, I just want to check out a few things. Can you look out that window right there? And my mom looked out and she said, what are those green things on the trees that you're seeing? And mom kind of looks worried and then she shrugs and she can't say anything. And she says, okay, no problem. Look at those vehicles going down the street. What do you call those smaller vehicles? Obviously meaning a car. And mom looked and she, you know, shrugged. And then my brother said, ask her what her favorite Sunday morning talk show is. Mrs. Bradley, what's your favorite Sunday morning talk show? Fried Zakaria, GPS, she says. Like without a hesitation. Mom had not spoken. Here's
That's amazing.
Mom is engaged in the world. Mom is she reads the New York Times and the Washington Post cover to cover every single day. CNN is always on. She is engaged in other people's lives. She has a lot of friends. Most of her friends have died, but she has friends in my generation who come to her for wisdom and all of that. She's engaged with people. She's engaged with the world. She has a purpose in life. She has a reason to get up every day. She sees her kids all the time. I mean, we visit her almost every day. So mom is the embodiment of how to do midlife well. It's about not so much investing inward, but being engaged with the world, being engaged with other people, being interested in life. And mom, I watch mom and I think that is what I want to do.
Well, what's the next book, Barbara?
Oh my gosh, I have no idea. I wish I did. Oh my goodness.
There's so many subtopics here, you know.
There are a lot of subtopics here, and I'm interested in you know what? I just don't know. I'm kind of interested in good and evil and looking at how the whole idea of good and evil is changing, but that's a whole different topic.
Well, and it's an unfair question because the book is just out today, so thank you
traumatic.
So much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
It was great fun. Thank you.
That's Barbara Bradley Haggerty, again, author of two books, including the latest just out called Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. To listen to today's full conversation, go to nhpr.org/exchange or tune in tonight at The Exchange, NHPR, at tune in tonight at 8 p.m. The Exchange engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producer is Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.